It's October 1988, Holmdel, New Jersey. A nervous 28-year-old French researcher named Jan LeCun is standing in this crisp corporate office.
Right, quite a change of scenery for him.
Oh, totally. Just days prior, he was in this poorly funded Paris lab, literally scavenging discarded computers just to run his experiments. And now he's tentatively handing his new boss a massive purchase request for a highly expensive, top-of-the-line UniX workstation.
Which is a bold move for the new guy.
Right. And that workstation, as we're going to explore today in our deep dive into the book, The Machine That Reads Handwriting, specifically Chapter 3, The Visual Cortex of Holmdel, well, that computer would eventually run the code that forms the bedrock of modern deep learning.
Yeah, and the boss taking that paper was Larry Jackall. He was the head of the Adaptive Systems Research Department at AT&T Bell Labs. And, you know, LeCun is bracing for this huge argument over the price tag. But instead, Jackall just glances at the request and delivers this line that essentially sets the tone for the next decade of AI history. He says, "Yeah, you know, why Bell Labs? You don't get famous by saving money."
I mean, that is just a completely different philosophy of research, right?
Oh, absolutely.
So today we are exploring exactly what that money bought. We're showing you how a biological experiment on a cat's brain from the 1960s somehow became the structural blueprint for the algorithms that, you know, read our mail, process our bank deposits, and really just power modern AI.
That's a wild trajectory.
It really is.
Yeah.
Okay, let's unpack this because to truly understand the magnitude of what LeCun was attempting in 1988, we kind of need to understand just how hostile the academic climate was toward neural networks at the time.
Yeah, hostile is the right word. It was the dead of the AI winter. And this freeze, it actually started way back in 1969.
Right, with Minsky and Papert.
Exactly. Marvin Minsky and Seymour Papert published this devastating mathematical critique of early neural networks, which were called perceptrons back then. And that single paper, it effectively evaporated funding for neural network research for, gosh, over a decade.
Just wiped it out.
Pretty much. So by the late 80s, the entire academic consensus has shifted over to what they called symbolist AI. This was the era of expert systems. The mainstream establishment firmly believed that true intelligence meant hand coding these rigid Boolean logic rules into a machine.
So they thought you just needed a big enough rule book.
Right. The whole idea that a computer could just ingest raw data and figure out patterns on its own, that was dismissed as borderline pseudoscience.
Which is crazy in hindsight because, I mean, symbolist AI assumes the world can be perfectly categorized, but if you try to apply rigid logic to something as fluid as, say, human handwriting, the system immediately breaks down.
It shatters on contact with reality.
Right, like take the number three. A rule-based system might define a three as a two connected right-facing semicircles, but
Yeah.
handwriting is this analog dynamic action. People add hooks, they skew the angle, they rush and turn into this messy
They
zigzag.
write it like a backwards E.
Exactly. The moment you write a definitive rule for a three-pun, I can instantly show you a perfectly legible handwritten three-pun that violates your rule. LeCun recognized that trying to hard code exceptions for a messy reality was just an infinite, unsolvable loop. He believed intelligence had to be taught by showing examples, not by, you know, writing dictionaries of rules.
Right, but holding that belief made LeCun something of an academic outcast back in France. Bell Labs, however, was this massive anomaly. It's a well-funded greenhouse that was completely insulated from the academic winters raging outside.
They did invent the transistor, after all.
Exactly. They had this legacy of funding fundamental physics and math. So they had this culture of just putting brilliant unconventional thinkers in a room, handing them top-tier hardware, and letting them tackle seemingly impossible problems without demanding any immediate commercial returns.
Which brings us right back to that UniX workstation. Because to teach a machine by example, LeCun needed massive computational power to process images. But the thing is, silicon alone wasn't enough. He needed a structural blueprint for the software.
And computer science textbooks at the time just didn't have a functional model for machine vision.
No, they didn't. So LeCun looked at the only system in the universe that actually worked biological vision. And to understand that, we have to wind the clock back a bit to 1962 to a Harvard laboratory.
Right, the famous cat experiment. Two neurophysiologists, David Hubel and Torsten Weisel, were trying to map out the mammalian visual system. So they anesthetized a cat, delicately inserted these tiny microelectrodes into its primary visual cortex at the back of the brain, and monitored the electrical activity while they showed the cat spots of light on a screen.
And initially, it was a total failure, right?
Complete failure. The neurons in the cat's cortex weren't responding to the dots of light in any predictable way at all. They were stumped.
But then the breakthrough happens because of a mechanical accident.
Exactly. As they were slipping a glass slide into their projector, the sharp moving edge of the glass cast this faint shadow across the screen. And suddenly, the microelectrodes registered this massive explosion of neuronal firing.
Oh, wow. So it wasn't the dots.
No, the visual cortex wasn't looking for dots at all. It was explicitly wired to detect moving edges at specific orientations. That accidental discovery fundamentally reshaped neuroscience, and it actually won them a Nobel Prize later on.
That's incredible.
It is. They mapped out this clear biological hierarchy. Light hits the retina, gets compressed, travels through this relay center called the lateral geniculate nucleus, or LGN, and finally arrives at the primary visual cortex. And inside that cortex, Hubel and Neisel identified two distinct types of processing cells, which they called simple and complex cells.
And the division of labor between these two is just incredibly elegant. I mean, simple cells, they operate with extreme tunnel vision, right?
Right, very localized.
They only monitor a tiny localized patch of the visual field, their local receptive field. So a simple cell might only fire if it detects a perfectly vertical edge in the top left corner of your vision. But obviously, to build a cohesive picture of the world, those hyper-specific signals have to be aggregated somehow.
And that's exactly what the complex cells do. They pool the outputs from multiple simple cells together. And by doing that, they grant the visual system this crucial property called spatial invariance.
Spatial invariance, which basically means...
It means that if you shift your gaze slightly, or if the object you're looking at moves just a fraction of an inch, the complex cell still recognizes that vertical edge as the exact same edge. It abstracts the exact location into a relative feature.
So dots become lines, lines become patterns, and eventually that raw light becomes a recognized object.
Exactly. Local edge detectors feed into pooling cells, building up the complexity step by step.
But wait, if we're giving Lakin the credit for translating this into computer science, I have to point out that the biological map itself wasn't his discovery. Because a Japanese engineer, Kunihiko Fukushima, actually built a neural network called the neocognitron way back between 1979 and 1980.
Yes, he did.
And it exactly mimicked this simple to complex cell hierarchy. He layered edge detectors and pooling layers just like the cat's brain. So if the map already existed, why didn't it work for messy data like handwriting? Why are we focusing on Lakin in 1988 instead of Fukushima a decade earlier?
That is a great question. The issue is that Fukushima's neocognitron lacked a unified mathematical engine. He definitely had the biological architecture down, but he didn't have an efficient way to make the entire network learn from its mistakes all at once.
Oh.
His system had to be trained layer by layer in this somewhat disjointed, unsupervised fashion. It couldn't globally optimize itself toward a single goal. What Lakin brought to the table, the missing link, was backpropagation.
Right, backpropagation.
But the backward propagation of errors. I mean, it's this mechanism that calculates exactly how wrong the network's final guess was and then mathematically traces that error backward through every single layer of the network.
Exactly. It calculates the gradient. Yeah, it calculates the gradient of the error and slightly tweaks thousands of individual connection weights simultaneously so that the next time, the guess will be just a little bit closer to the truth. It basically orchestrates that entire biological architecture toward a single objective.
Precisely. Lakin realized that the key to machine vision wasn't just blindly copying the cat's brain. It was marrying that biological structure with the sheer mathematical learning power of backpropagation.
But actually executing that marriage on the hardware of the late 1980s, I mean, that presented a massive geometrical problem.
Oh, a total nightmare.
Because in a standard fully connected neural network, every artificial neuron in one layer connects to every single neuron in the next layer. If you feed even a tiny image, like a 256 by 256 pixel image, into a fully connected network, the numbers just explode.
Yeah, the first layer alone generates tens of thousands of inputs, which multiply into millions of individual weights.
And the math instantly melts the hardware.
It really does.
Mm-mm.
But even if you had a supercomputer capable of crunching those millions of parameters back then, you run headfirst into another mathematical wall, which is overfitting.
Right, overfitting. It's kind of like, imagine a student who memorizes an entire practice test perfectly, but then they completely fail the actual exam because a single word in the question was changed.
That's a perfect analogy.
When a network has millions of adjustable weights, but only a limited data set of training images, it doesn't actually learn to generalize. It just memorizes the training data. The machine memorizes rather than learns.
Exactly. To fix this, LeCun had to fundamentally change the geometry of the network. He did it by imposing strict constraints. Instead of giving the network complete freedom to connect everything to everything, he restricted its architecture based on the physical properties of images.
So he forced it to look through a tiny window.
Yes, a tiny moving window, just 5 by 5 pixels wide. This perfectly mirrored the local receptive fields of the simple cells in Hubel and Weisel's cat.
But the true elegance of this architecture is how it actually uses that tiny window.
Yeah, and what's fascinating here is a mathematical trick LeCun implemented called weight sharing. LeCun understood this basic truth about our visual universe translational invariance.
Which means an edge is an edge, no matter where it is.
Exactly. An edge detector that's useful in the top left corner of an image is mathematically just as useful in the bottom right corner. So he realized it was wildly inefficient to force the network to independently learn thousands of separate edge detectors for every single pixel coordinate.
Right.
Instead, he forced the network to learn one highly optimized 5x5 detector, a kernel, and use those exact same mathematical weights across the entire image.
It takes that 5x5 kernel and just sweeps it across the entire image, pixel by pixel, asking, does this specific edge exist here? How about here? And that sliding motion is called convolution.
Which is where we get the name.
Yeah, convolutional neural network. And it drastically cuts down the processing power required. Because instead of learning millions of individual parameters, the network only has to learn the weights for that tiny sliding kernel. It creates a feature map showing exactly where those specific edges are located, reducing the required parameters by a massive factor.
And that's just the convolution layer. To mimic the complex cells, he had to add the second half of the equation pooling. Once the convolution layer detects a feature, the pooling layer intentionally degrades the exact spatial coordinates of that detection. It effectively blurs the map.
Which honestly sounds counterproductive at first.
It does.
Until you realize that exact coordinates are the enemy of recognizing messy handwriting. Like, if network memorizes that the top curve of a 3 must be exactly at pixel coordinate IS42Y18, it will completely fail the moment someone writes a slightly smaller 3.
Right, because it shifted.
Exactly. Pooling essentially says, I don't care exactly where the curve is, I just care that it roughly exists in the upper right quadrant relative to a joint in the lower quadrant. By blurring the exact location, the network learns to care about the relative position, which creates that spatial invariance we talked about.
This architecture, the CNN, is unarguably brilliant, but it actually triggered a profound philosophical debate in the cognitive science community at the time.
Oh, with Gary Marcus.
Right, the cognitive psychologist Gary Marcus.
Yeah.
He famously argued that LeCun was, philosophically speaking, cheating. By hardwiring things like convolutions, weight sharing, and local receptive windows into the system, Marcus claimed LeCun wasn't building a true machine that learns from a blank slate.
He argued he pre-wired human knowledge into it.
Exactly. Smuggling human knowledge about spatial invariance into the architecture, which, according to Marcus, essentially proved the rule-based simulist partly right.
But LeCun's rebuttal was so calm and grounded purely in physics. I mean, he pointed out that weight sharing isn't an arbitrary human-invented rule. It just acknowledges the physical symmetry of the universe.
It's just how space works.
Right. Even human retinas have hardwired structural constraints dictated by physics and evolution. LeCun argued he was simply giving the machine the bare minimum physical scaffolding necessary to interact with two-dimensional space. The machine still had to learn the actual features, the curves and edges, from raw pixels.
It's a fascinating philosophical debate. But, you know, Bell Labs was an engineering environment. Philosophical debates are fun, but in 1989, LeCun had to prove this elegant math actually worked in the real messy world.
And the ultimate test was waiting for him. The U.S. Postal Service provided this massive database of zip codes digitally scanned from envelopes in Buffalo, New York.
And this data was incredibly messy.
Oh, it was a nightmare. Scrawled, smudged ink, varying pen pressures. It was so chaotic that when human researchers at Bell Labs' Jane Bromley and Edward Seckinger manually tried to transcribe the dataset, they had a 2.5% error rate.
Humans were getting it wrong 2.5% of the time. That tells you everything about the data quality.
Exactly. So to truly appreciate what LeCun did here, we kind of have to contrast it with the prevailing engineering mindset of the time.
Right, like his colleague John Denker. Just months earlier, in November 1988, Denker made a system to tackle this exact same zip code problem. But it relied heavily on handcrafted human filters at the front end. Human engineers had to write algorithms to extract the features before handing it over to the neural network.
But LeCun absolutely insisted on end-to-end learning. He wanted raw pixels in, answers out, with everything in between entirely adjusted by backpropagation. Zero human hand-holding.
And the machine he built to do this, LeNet 1, just perfectly showcased the power of his architectural constraints. The network technically contained over 64,000 connections, but because of weight sharing, it actually only had to learn about 9,760 unique values.
And here's where it gets really interesting. Because the architecture was so lean, it was incredibly fast. Running on a custom AT&T chip, the DSP32C, and using a technique called stochastic gradient descent.
Where it updates after every single example.
Right. Instead of waiting for a whole batch, it updates constantly. Because of that, it was capable of recognizing a handwritten digit in just 0.015 seconds.
The speed is incredible, but the final results are what really changed everything. It achieved a 1% error rate, but even more importantly, it had a 9% rejection rate.
The rejection rate is such a brilliant concept because in real-world engineering, misrouting mail is disastrous.
It's incredibly expensive.
Yeah. So training the AI to effectively raise its hand and say, I don't know, this is too messy, a human needs to look at this, that's the secret to practical AI deployment. By handing that 9% off to humans, the machines stayed incredibly accurate on the rest.
It really is. And the big takeaway here is the historical impact. LeNet 1 provided the empirical proof that broke the AI winter. It proved human designers didn't need to handcraft features anymore. Machines could learn them directly from data.
It was a massive paradigm shift, one that eventually won LeCun, along with Jeffrey Hinton and Yoshua Bengio, the 2018 Turing Award.
But, you know, solving single zip code digits was really just the beginning. The next frontier was American banks. They desperately wanted machines to read entirely connected strings of cursive numbers on checks, which is a fundamentally different and much harder problem than isolated digits.
It's a whole new level of complexity. Which brings us to a final thought for you, the listener, to ponder. Think about that Gary Marcus debate we discussed earlier. If the key to unlocking artificial intelligence wasn't giving the machine absolute freedom, but rather restricting its freedom based on the physical laws of our universe-like weight sharing, what does that say about human intelligence?
That's a great question.
Are our own minds powerful because of how much we can flexibly learn, or because of the strict evolutionary constraints nature built into us before we even open our eyes?
If we connect this to the bigger picture, it suggests that true intelligence isn't a blank slate. It's the perfect marriage of structure and experience.
Beautifully put. Keep questioning the structure of the world around you, and we'll catch you on the next deep dive.